and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your host, Big Waz, aka Wozniak Lambre, joined as always by my partner in crime, my comrade, the wonderful, the beautiful Nando Vila. What's up, Nando?
How's it going, Waz? I missed you last week, dude.
Oh, man, you guys killed that episode, man. Like, y'all put me up on game on Latin American politics. The listeners thoroughly enjoyed it. I saw we got some great feedback, so thank you for that. And this week we got a special guest, our brother Joshua Khan Russell of Choose Democracy. He's an activist, an organizer, just an all-around mensch. Thank you for joining us this week on today's show. Tom Cotton has already started his campaign for the presidency in 2024. The guys, you know, he's getting his frequent flyer miles in, man. He doesn't have a primary challenger in Arkansas, so he's free to do essentially whatever the hell it is he wants with this time right now. And he's choosing to get a leg up on the competition for 2024, which, as you know, I'm no mathematician, but that's 4 years from now. We're going to get into what it means for Tom Cotton to be already running for president. But first, the GOP's at it again. They're clearly getting smoked in the polls nationally everywhere. Battleground states, typical Republican strongholds in places like Georgia and Texas. They're in dogfights over there. They can see the writing on the wall. And so basically they're trying to put a monkey wrench in this thing at every single turn. And in the courts where, you know, now that they've got six conservative Supreme Court justices, they can essentially do whatever they want if it ever has to come to that. And they're doing it everywhere. And of course, they're using Bush v. Gore as an example of exactly what they think they should do in case they get creamed in November. And quite frankly, obviously, it's disgusting, but this is par for the course for the GOP, right? Like, we talk about it every day on this show. They're the party that understands how to wield power, and they do it in the open. This is not back channel. This isn't in secret. They're telling everybody, telegraphing what they want to do, right? You see some of the ballot box initiatives in Texas and Georgia where they're limiting where people can go for early voting, mail-in voting. This Trump is, you know, he's empowering his cronies at places like the Postal Service to sabotage people who don't want to go in and vote. It's obvious desperation. Like, I've never seen this before in a national campaign so openly and brazenly just trying to thwart democracy. Nando, please sort of get into what these guys are doing a little bit more in depth in the different states around us.
Well, yeah, I think a good place to start for everyone is there's an HBO documentary that just came out, directed by Billy Corbin and produced by Adam McKay, called 537 Votes. It's about how the 2000 election was stolen from Al Gore by the Republicans with the help of, you know, some very corrupt shenanigans in Miami-Dade County where I grew up. And I remember that time very, very well. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to happen again. I mean, they're going to try again to steal the election. They're laying the groundwork for it. They're, like you said, they're limiting the amount that people can vote. They're limiting access to the vote. But even if they do lose, they are almost certainly going to try to do some sort of challenge in the courts to overturn the results. Brett Kavanaugh has already laid the groundwork. He's already citing Bush v. Gore as a legal precedent, which they claimed at the time they wouldn't cite it as legal precedent. Brett Kavanaugh, I remind you, was a lawyer at the time for the Bush campaign, helping them steal the 2000 election. Now he's on the Supreme Court. Our guest today, Joshua Khan Russell, you are on the forefront of the battle to stop that, to stop what you guys are calling a coup, the sort of stealing of an election, a just overturning the will of the people through what I guess in this case would be the judiciary and an assist from like Republican state legislatures and governors across the country. Tell us like what your organization is doing, what you plan on doing, and how you just see this election in the next week.
Yeah, well, First, thanks for having me on. It's fun to make my Woke Bros debut. Love you guys. And that intro really, I think, nailed it. Oh, shit. People are actually knocking at my door. This is ridiculous.
Federal agents.
All right. Thanks for rolling with that.
Hey, man, it's dangerous being a commie, man.
Yeah, you know I was ready for the feds to be knocking in me. chaos everywhere. And we're anticipating a period of potential chaos, you know, starting on Election Day moving forward. So we got together, we being, you know, so my background, I've spent the last 20 years organizing with social movements for racial justice and climate change, doing support work, learning from movements all around the world who have faced all kinds of corrupt and authoritarian governments, including here at home, but also in lots of other places like Turkey and the Philippines. And so I also have gotten to see firsthand how bad things can get. As bad as things are now here, they can get a lot worse. And so when Trump started tweeting out that he wasn't going to accept the election results, a number of us who are nonviolent direct action trainers from a bunch of different social movements, particularly from the labor movement, including some OGs like folks from the civil rights movement. One of our lead trainers was one of the coordinators of Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964. We all got together and said, we need to actually start preparing for a lot of the different scenarios that are possible, right? So we're not saying that we think a coup is going to happen, but we're saying that there's enough of a threat of it that it would be foolish to not prepare, and also that it would be foolish to rely on the Democrats to handle it, right? Because we do. It's good that you mentioned 2000, because we call that a coup also, right? So like the Cliff Notes version of what happened was there was election irregularities. The Republicans basically said that it was fraudulent. There was a recount. They went to the courts to try to stop the recount. And then as the result, it got punted to the Supreme Court. They gave it to George Bush. And then later when the recount finished, it turns out that Gore would have won. And so there's a lot that we can learn from that. But one of the things is that the Democrats were ready to capitulate and that they, you know, and it's not even just the Democrats, to be clear, like, and I'll talk about this more in a second, but we learned from a lot of other countries too, that like the impulse of the politicians is to negotiate, right? And mm-hmm. So one of the things that we've learned is that, so half of all attempted coups since the 1950s all around the world have failed. One is because coups are hard to pull off. Also a lot of them are stopped by people power. And so the reason why we use that word is not because we're imagining that there's like going to be tanks rolling in the streets. We're not imagining that, like, you know, that Trump will lose the election. Everyone will agree that he lost the election. And then he's just like, I'm not going anyway. Like, we're not imagining those kinds of scenarios. Instead, what we're imagining is, you know, so we call it a coup either if someone claims victory before all the votes are counted, which was it yesterday? I think it was the day before. He said, like, no, like, we have to call it on the day of. We're not going to count ballots afterwards. Yeah. So he's already saying he wants to try that. Or if they try to stop the counting, right? So if, like, there's injunctions filed, whatever, they try to stop ballots from being counted. And then the third is there's a lot of versions of ways he would refuse to accept a loss, including, for example, like, getting, you know, these Republican-controlled state legislatures to say, like, yeah, our state looks like it voted for Biden, but actually, you know, we think most of those ballots are fake and fraudulent because they're mail-in. So we're going to say our states, you know, we're going to send the electors to the Electoral College to vote for Trump. And when that happens, the Constitution's actually mad vague about it. Like, it's like there's a convoluted process, and this isn't, you know, let me also just say this is not unprecedented, both with like the two stuff in 2000, but in that scenario where like states, both like the governor and the legislators, send in different slates of electors, that happened in 1876 when the country was even more divided than it was now. And the only way that it was resolved was basically it was resolved like the eve of the inauguration through like a grand bargain. And it was like, I can curse, right? I think I actually,
Fuck yeah, you can curse.
It was the most fucked up bargain that was struck in our, you know, like basically, so it was the end of Reconstruction, right? So after the Civil War, in particular, when a lot of black folks had electoral power, black elected officials, there was a bargain that signaled basically the end of Reconstruction and the ushering of Jim Crow, which is the legacy that we're living with now. And that was the way they like saved the process, right? So we don't want to leave it up to that, right? We don't want a repeat of 2000, and we don't want a repeat of that. And so among this group of movement trainers, a number of us have worked supporting freedom movements in other countries that have defeated coups, including in places like Thailand in 1992 and Argentina in 1987. And we've been drawing on a lot of the research of like how are coups defeated. And there's a lot of data there that we can learn from. And one of the things that we learn is that like there's actually a lot of agent, like what the would-be coup plotters want us to believe that we have no agency, that it's like the shit's going to get settled in the courts and there's nothing we can do about that. And we just have to like watch and go along with it. And that's not true. Right. But it does mean for us, part of why we started this project called Choose Democracy was to help both psychologically and logistically prepare people to do what is necessary, which is like first by psychologically prepare, we mean like get over the American exceptionalism, the idea that it can't happen here. Of course it can happen here. It's already happened.
It's already happened here.
Exactly. So that's like part one. And then part two is seeding a strategy framework that's actually grounded in historical data so that when shit gets wild, it's not just like the left flailing in the streets. Because honestly, if we move into activist mode, which is like, that's my normal mode, like we're going to lose. Like if people come out into the streets and just start being anti-Trump and protesting Trump, that's not going to change anything, right? Because their side's going to come out. We're just going to have the narrative's going to be like, oh, shit's polarized. And so instead, what we've learned from coups in a lot of these other countries is that what's going on is there's a contest for legitimacy, right? And so we need to be able to mobilize in order to swing the balance of power in basically, so like the Trump campaign's going to call it fraudulent and say that they're the real winners. The Biden campaign is going to say that we're the real winners. I'm not saying this is going to happen in a scenario that might get this way, right? There's competing claims to the throne, you know? And so then who gets to decide, who gets to arbitrate, who's going to inherit the throne? And if they try to punt it into various courts, maybe going up to the Supreme Court, these things are not apolitical, right? So they make decisions also based on what's going on in the country at the time, right? And so the reason why we use the word coup is that it gives us time to prepare. Like if in 2000 in the approach, if that was called a potential coup, we would have had time to organize and people could have had a sense of their role. And so part of what we've learned is that the logic is not the logic of protest. It's the logic of noncompliance. So what that means is that when there's a contest for legitimacy, like, I know I've been talking a lot. Should I just keep going? Is this
keep going? Correct? Go ahead. Keep going.
So like, here's how we think about power, right? So if here I'm making a triangle with my fingers, this is like the roof of a house, right? That's the administration. That's a regime, right? That roof is held up by different pillars. Those pillars are the different social blocks of society. So like the roof is held up by labor. It's held up by capital. It's held up by the media. It's held up by the military. It's held up by the police. There's all different kinds of institutions, right? Some of those we have control over. Some of those we don't have control over. The ones that we have control over, if you yank the pillars out, it makes it weak enough that the whole roof falls down, right? And so when countries become ungovernable, the would-be coup plot, so like in Germany in 1920, for example, there was an attempt at a put, there's this guy, this right-wing leader named Wolfgang Kopp, right? He got the military on his side.
This great is
the military.
Right-wing guy name.
Yeah, totally. Wolfgang Kopp. Yeah, exactly. They're like, sounds like a member of Motorhead or like a German punk band. And so they like went into the Capitol building, declared themselves the new government, and all the government workers who were like career bureaucrats basically were like, we're not putting up with this shit. And they walked out and went on strike, right? All the different industries went on strike because they had a well-organized labor movement, and they shut the country down. And they weren't governable, right? And the people won in 4 days. Like, is that, there's all these funny stories from that example of, like, you know, he was in there, and this was obviously at the time of typewriters and when, like, a lot of men couldn't type. And so they went and all the, he had like his manifesto, his declaration, and there was no one there to type it up. So he couldn't even, and none of the newspapers would print it. Right?
Got you.
And so, like, that's the logic of non-compliance, is we're actually going to not participate. So here's what our project is doing, which is that we put.
Hold on, before you start with that, I just want to jump in with something, because I think you brought up something that's important when it comes to the pillars of society not playing ball, right? I think, you know, I think if you read a lot of the stuff out there about the courts specifically, you know, there are people who are sort of jurist fetishist who are like, look, when Trump tried to do things like, say, the Muslim ban, the court stepped up and was like, you can do a ban, but you have to, like, do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, there were times throughout the regime's administration where the court sort of was like, look, man, you can't just do this all haphazardly and, you know, just disorganized. Just the administration has proven itself to be dysfunctional, disorganized at every single turn. I think there are people who think that they can't really pull it off, but would it be the regime pulling it off, or would it be the GOP as a whole and sort of the mechanisms around the GOP trying to pull this off?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's a chaos situation. I definitely don't think they have their shit together.
Right.
That's for sure. And I don't think they're aligned. But also, the Trump administration's been building legal machinery for this for a year now. And so, and there's so many factors at play. And so there's like, that's part of the whole contest of legitimacy thing is also about like peeling off defectors. So making it harder for the institutions to go along with the bullshit, right? And so we actually have good news that just happened, right? So in Pennsylvania, House Republicans proposed an open-ended subpoena-wielding commission with the authority to seize uncounted ballots. And they called it the election integrity plan. And so they were saying like all these ballots are going to be fraudulent. So we're going to basically create this thing that'll seize them. And within days of it going public, there was such outcry that a bunch of the like moderate Republicans bailed. They just jumped ship. They were like, I can't actually sustain this. Right.
Got you.
If there weren't pressure on them, that would have held together.
Easier.
Yeah, but it crumbled. So that's a good sign, right? And so right. we're trying to shift the balance of forces as much as we can in as many of those scenarios. So you know, we're not saying this shit's definitely going to happen. In fact, you know, and so the best way to prevent a coup, yeah.
Joshua, I think it's important to, you're not saying that this is definitely going to happen. What I think is definitely going to happen is that they will try something.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the fact that they're just going to be like, we're going to count the votes. And may the best man win. That is 100%
not going to happen.
Yeah. You know, Trump and the Republicans will try something. The question is, how much stomach do they have? How well organized they are, and how much resistance there is to it. It could be that, you know, they do some sort of half-hearted attempt, but it's not enough, and they go away. But something will be tried. I think is obvious to me at least. That so I think that what you're doing in preparing for any eventualities is obviously the wise thing to do. It's not necessarily going to be, like you said, tank on the streets, but something will happen.
Yeah, exactly. And so therefore, let's get ready, you know? And so that's what we're doing, is getting ready and getting ready for whatever. And so, which means both we are scenario planning. We are trying to imagine what are the most likely scenarios, and I can share more about that. But it's also about getting organized to be able to handle, like, another thing that's probably going to happen is a lot of misinformation is going to be out there. Basically, there's going to be like a narrative war going on about, probably centered on the whole like mail-in ballot thing, but some other kind of election fraudulence thing. They're going to find some random irregularity somewhere and use that to say that the whole thing should be tossed out, whatever. And so what's happening, so what we're doing is we made a pledge. And the pledge is just an organizing tool, right? So the pledge has four parts. The pledge is, number one, we're going to vote. We'll participate in the process. Number two, because we wouldn't have much of a leg to stand on to try to defend the integrity of a process we're not even participating in. But then number two, we refuse to accept any election results until all the votes are counted. Then number three, we're going to nonviolently take to the streets if a coup is attempted, coup defined in the way that I defined it earlier. And then number four, we're willing to shut down the country if necessary in order to defend, you know, the integrity of the process. And so it's an escalation arc, right? And so we're not saying we're going to get to the point where we need to shut down the country, but we are going to be in an environment where, like, if shit really does go that way, we will find really shifting terrain, and we'll also find unlikely alliances. And so part of the – when I was saying talking before about, like, about, you know, contest of legitimacy and the logic of noncompliance, the other thing that we're helping people on the left do is get out of – there's, like, a left mindset that's, like – you know, so I've spent, you know, the last 20 years as an organizer always frustrated with the way that, for example, the Democrats constantly tack towards some mythologized center instead of actually building their power in a progressive base. We all hate that shit,
but that's
right?
What makes them Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But this moment, for these next 3 months, this is a moment where we're going for the center. We're trying to push an uncertain center off the fence, and we're trying to peel off defectors, right? And we're trying to make it harder for people to carry out illegal orders with, like, ballot tampering and shit like that, right? And we're trying to make it easier for people to stand up to orders from Republican state legislatures and stuff like that. And so the way that we've been building, so we so far have about 35,000 people who signed the pledge. We're just getting started. There's a lot of other groups who are doing similar pledges too. And when people sign the pledge, they get on our list, and we've been training people every other day. We have thousands of people per training. So we're training thousands and thousands of people in things like action planning, in doing some political education on the history of this stuff, in getting people ready to take action on their own, rooting in the principles of, like, these are the things that have worked, right? So this isn't an ideological project at all. We're just leaning into, like, you know, so, like, for example, like, there's a debate on the left about the role of property destruction and looting and violence and nonviolence. We're like, that's an interesting debate. That's not what we're talking about right now. In a contest for legitimacy, nonviolent movements work because, number one, we're trying to pull everyone and your mom out into the streets. And so it being nonviolent is the best way to get mass participation. And then number two,
My mom is fully, like, radicalized, by the way, I'll have you know.
She's throwing bricks.
She's a hardcore Bernie bro.
I used a mom reference when I was on TMBS this last week, and Leisha was like, my mom is not nonpartisan. This is your Leisha pushing back. But and then the other is that, like, you know, they have, like, a violent street movement, whether it's through these paramilitaries or the Proud Boys or whatever. And so as much of a distinction we can draw between us and them, the better, right? Which is why part of the trainings are also in de-escalation. And so it's not just, you know, we choose democracy. We're not trying to, like, organize the whole resistance. We're part of a huge network of thousands of groups who are organizing right now. And there's groups like the Dream Defenders in Florida, who are, yeah, you know, a black organization that formed after Trayvon Martin got murdered. They have a grassroots network all over Florida, right? Really important swing state. And right now they're doing trainings in de-escalation to be able to go to the polls. And if there's, like, armed, you know, assholes trying to intimidate people, they're there to de-escalate and like protect people at the polls. Like, so it's with each step of the way, you know, there's a lot of steps that are before the shut down the country step. Yeah. And that's an example of one of them. And they're working with groups like Sunrise, to be doing the same thing. So there's, like, by now hundreds of thousands of people who've been trained in this kind of stuff, in how to do action planning, in how to do civil resistance, in how to do de-escalation, especially in swing states. And then in addition to the trainings, then there's, like, we have guides on our website that help map out the scenarios if that's useful for folks. And then we also have, like, an action hub that, like, now that we're getting closer to the election, where there's actions that people can plug into. So, like, what's happening right now, for example, there's a group called Protect Our Election, and they're doing, like, letter writing campaigns to elected officials, basically with the pledge. And normally I don't think, like, I think petitions and letter writing are really, they're rarely effective as a tactic. But in this case, part of what we're doing is trying to, like, strengthen the spines of those election officials so that if they get orders to throw out ballots or whatever, they'll think twice and know there's, like, a huge activated base of support that will actually show up, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, similarly, like The Pledge is a tool that people are trying to pressure politicians to sign it. There's a group called Hold the Line that's doing similar things. There's like there's a group called Protect the Results, which is like a big kind of center left coalition of like over 100 organizations that are holding rallies on November 4th that are like set the tone to make sure this is like about democracy and not about Trump. You know, like we want it to not be the circus and instead like yeah. And that's the other thing that we've learned from, you know, so like when Argentina, when there was like an attempted coup, they weren't, you know, so there's this like major, like there was this major in the military, Ernesto Barrio, I think, Barriero. And they weren't just like, you know, banners chanting against him. They were saying, long live Argentina, long live democracy, you know? And so that's like, it's trying to set the tone for that. And then there's, the next stage after that would be if they do try to stop the counting of ballots at different board of elections and places like that, there'd be rallies and actions at the board of elections to actually defend the ballots from being interrupted from being counted. So there's, and that's a thing that we learned from 2002 with, I mean, sorry, 2000 as well.
Yeah. Yeah. 2000 TOO. Yeah. The Brooks Brothers riot. It was, it was crucial. These Republican operatives posing as like, regular grassroots people literally invading the government building in Miami and chanting and harassing ballot counters. It's crazy. I mean, if people don't remember that time or people are too young to remember that time, I highly recommend you go watch that documentary ahead of the election and realize just how easy it was for them to do it. Mm-hmm. That's what was shocking to me, is just how easy it was for them to steal the election, how little resistance the Democrats put up. And it's not like the Democrats have gotten more radical.
I mean, look at
how they laid down for Amy Coney Barrett, right? Like, people like regular kind of rank and file Democrats were rightfully horrified when RBG died. They flooded the Democratic Party with donations, gave them $500 million in like 3 days of donations, to which the Democratic Party said, thank you very much. We're going to do literally nothing. Literally nothing.
Well, no, but just no, you know, they put out, you know, anonymous comments in Vox saying, we're pissed. You guys crossed us this time. Like, all right. Show me. Don't tell me. So, Josh.
Can I say one other thing?
Yes, please. Go on.
First, just about the Brooks Brothers riots. That's a thing when Waz, you were doing the opening about how the Republicans understand power. They have an inside-outside strategy, right? Like, they in 2000, they had an inside strategy with the courts. And an outside strategy with street protests to actually disrupt the narrative. And the Democrats never have an outside strategy. No. And the movements that I come out of only have an outside strategy. And so in this moment, it's like, you know, I do imagine, you know, I trust that the Democrats are trying to hire lawyers and stuff like that, but they think that that's enough and it's not enough. And so not only do we need an outside strategy, but in the process of building an outside strategy, and I can talk more about this in a little bit if you want to go this way.
Hold on, I want to contextualize that for people listening at home, right? Mm-hmm. We have a modern example of this, the Tea Party. That was some fake-ass populist uprising, completely and utterly funded by, even if you don't want to call the Kochs and people like them Republican insiders, they fund the Republican Party. Like, that's the Republican Party literally paying for a fake-ass populist uprising. Say whatever you want about Antifa or whoever. They ain't got shit to do with the Dems. The Dems have nothing to do with any sort of actual organizing principle on the streets. Like, normal, everyday people, they have no connection with that whatsoever. The closest you might get to something like that was like sort of Bernie Sanders' campaign, right? Where it's like, all right, we're hiring all these operatives. They're doing outreach in certain communities. They're getting people to understand what our message is. Like, you might, I guess you can kind of, you know, when it comes to Bernie's campaign, and especially, of course, Barack Obama's campaign, but those things, specifically Obama's campaign, was used in service of getting that man elected and nothing else, right? Yes, there was some sort of organizing principle about it and some sort of community organizing principle to it, but it's for one thing. It's for getting that dude elected, and nothing. We never mobilized these people.
Well, they shut it down. They shut it down after he got elected.
There you go. Yeah. Like, we don't mobilize.
Because they saw it as a threat.
Of course. Yeah,
exactly. And throughout Obama's presidency, this kind of outside direct action, like, really, really helped. I mean, the people don't remember, but, like, the Dreamers, like, had to occupy, literally physically occupy Obama for America offices and shut them down before they were taken seriously by the Obama administration, the Dreamer movement, and then not to mention Standing Rock, which people forget was during the Obama presidency, that whole Standing Rock thing that, you know.
That's so, what I'm so excited to start to, you know, if we get the opportunity to fight Biden, which is, that's how I think of voting, is I get to choose my opponent. And we,
I love
know,
that so much.
What?
I love that idea, that concept, that voting for somebody is who you are eventually going to have to fight, because all of the influences.
You let your opponent and Madden pick the Browns instead of, like, you exactly. know, the best team.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And it's, I mean, I think that, you know, my whole, so I've been organizing since the late 90s. I never had the luxury of ever imagining that I would have the chance to vote for someone who represented me. I mean, that was never, we never even thought of politicians that way until Bernie. That was, like, the first time we were like, oh, wow, there's, like, a lane. There's someone who is not a neoliberal. Like, that was a revelation. And, like, so it's all, and under Obama, so we built the Keystone XL campaign, which was the first campaign to go after him from the left for civil society. Yeah. And then after that, the DACA kids started chaining themselves to the gates, and then Occupy happened. And, like, my hope also is that, like, you know, if we're given a chance right now to have to fight for just a baseline of democracy, which is, like, on one hand, kind of depressing. Like, we don't really live in a real democracy right now. It's not that inspiring to say, like, we have to go to the streets to defend the ground that we stand. We have to defend the system as shitty as it is. But number one, that's the conditions we're in. And that if shit gets worse, it makes it a lot harder to organize. Right. The people who say, like, oh, if things get worse, it'll wake people up and then real change will happen. That's not historically grounded.
Like, in the meantime, people on breadlines, like, is that some kind of desirable outcome? I don't understand that logic.
Totally.
Well, and so, like, Joshua, I want to ask you about this concept of shutting down the country, because, you know, we have a very recent example in Bolivia in which there was a coup d'etat, and then there was basically a social uprising, and they were able to shut down the country. I mean, they have a very large trade union movement, and they called the general strike when the elections were, quote unquote, delayed. They called the general strike and shut down the country for weeks, and and they really did do that, and they forced the regime to give elections and to accept the results. And it was because of that ability that they had to shut down the country. Obviously, in the United States, we have nowhere near the union density that that Bolivia has. I mean, Bolivia has only 11 million people, but, you know, a very large organized working class of, you know, 3 or 4 million people are unionized there. So how are you thinking, in the eventuality that something does need to go down, how can you shut down the country with such low union density?
Yeah. Yes. It's only about 10% of workers are organized in unions here. And that is a different, you know, a lot of the countries that we look towards, they defeat coups within a number of days because everyone's unionized, right? We don't have that infrastructure, but we do have a lot more time than most other countries have had in terms of responding to coups. And so the thing that makes me hopeful is that, number one, if we get to that stage, which is, you know, months away, if it gets to that stage, we think the level of tectonic shifts that will be happening in our society will be escalatory, right? But right now, we already have. So, like, for example, the Rochester AFL-CIO, their central labor council, just made the commitment that if there's election tampering, they're going to go on strike, and they're calling on all AFL-CIO affiliates to do the same thing. They represent 70,000 workers alone. That's just one affiliate, right? The Seattle Educators Association just passed a similar resolution. The Detroit Postal Workers is printing up the Choose Democracy pledge with their official union letterhead. The National Union of Healthcare Workers just endorsed a pledge like this. There was just, you know, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which is a collaboration between the electrical workers and DSA, just convened a conversation with labor leaders that included, you know, like the flight attendants union head Sarah Nelson. Mm-hmm. So labor's really in this discussion, and there's ultimately, you know, it's going to depend on whether they decide to go to the mat for it. But every day we're getting more and more signs that they're ready to. And then in addition to that, there's then the question is like, okay, well, what about beyond organized labor? And so there's groups like, there's a group called Shutdown DC, which does have the capability of shutting down the whole like city of DC through block, you know, street blockades, like all kinds of stuff like that. They're doing trainings now specifically for government workers, like career bureaucrats, basically, to not go along with the coup plotters. They have a, there's a group called Feds for Democracy that just formed. There's another group called Democracy Kitchen. They're doing trainings for federal workers to basically disobey the orders that they're given by the Trump administration, right? So there's a lot of different kinds of signs. There's also groups like Dream Defenders and Sunrise are also organizing students to do a youth strike. And we don't think we actually need, you know, we don't have the capacity to do a general strike. I think it's a bit hyperbolic to imagine that we can actually pull that off. But what we're talking about is like, we're using the phrase rolling strikes. And so in that context, we're talking about like wildcat strikes, walkouts, sit downs, things like that, that are primarily driven by youth and labor. But if it escalates to that point, there's a lot of ways anybody can participate, like through what's called consumer strikes, which is sort of like the logic of a boycott, but it's not targeted towards a specific company. So it's like the holiday season coming up. And like, again, if we're trying to pull out those pillars, capital is kind of ambivalent in different ways. They're trying to see like, well, can we make more money this way or that way?
Yeah.
In general, capital usually breaks for fascism when faced like a choice with a choice like that.
Yeah.
But if we had people, engaging in a mass consumer strike over the holiday season, it would make capital think twice about, you know, what horse they're going to bet on and where they're going to throw their energy. And so this whole idea of peeling off defectors for us is about like in every given moment, using that pillar strategy with the tactics of noncompliance, depending on what's going on, there's different opportunities to pull at the pillars. And so that's why I'm hopeful that we would be able to pull this off if it escalated to that point. I'm also more hopeful that it won't have to escalate to that point. Yeah. But I don't think that we need to have the whole country going on a general strike in order to pull it off. I think rolling strikes all around the board can do it. And that's things like, and that can also be things like, you know, we're training people to go like shut down and occupy corporations and stuff like that. And it could be, you know, shutting down maintenance, transit, mail, trash. Like there's ways, there's key pillars to intervene on.
And I think why that's important. And I think what our listeners need to understand, part of getting to be our oligarchs is that it's fun. Like when it's an orderly society and they can go out and do whatever they want and live this beautiful life, it's great to be an oligarch. Now, if society is in shambles and in disarray, what the hell do you get to rule when you're the ruling class, right? And I think that's the pressure that you put on capital. It becomes, what's the point of all of this if we can't enjoy it? You know, exactly. And I think that's when you start to see, stuff like the way capital and corporations got very early on, got behind Black Lives Matter and things like that after George Floyd died. It's an easy calculation. It's like, look, man, if this shit gonna be riling people up in this way, this is bad for business. Right. Yeah, and that's always where the pendulum is going to swing when it comes to the, you know, the ruling class. Like what? Like there's nobody wants to rule over a burnt down castle. OK, like that's not fun.
Exactly. And so that's what I mean, both for capital, but also the courts. Also, basically, it's like we're increasing the level of risk. You know, is that that's part of how we see it. And a lot of the, you know, even though capital says like, well, we deserve to make all this money because we take all these, like, they're really not tolerant of risks, you know?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Joshua, assuming that you are able to stop a coup and Joe Biden wins and becomes the president, you know, I read this morning in CNBC that Wall Street has definitively broken for Joe Biden, he's raised much more money than Trump has from that particular sector, which just reminded me again of like the, I obviously prefer Biden. You know, I think we all agree that Biden in this like choose your fighter analogy is the better enemy to have. But we should have no illusions that Biden is our friend, that Biden is going to to do anything for us. What is step one for you once the Biden administration takes power?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm really excited to come out swinging. You know, there's a lot of the – so my other hat, I run an organization called the Wildfire Project, and we serve groups in a bunch of we serve labor organizations. We serve immigrant rights organizations. We serve, like, a lot of the groups in the movement for Black Lives. We serve indigenous sovereignty groups. And the last 4 years, people have been on defense, and they've been dealing with just, like, trying to stop their families from being ripped apart. I mean, like – and I think everyone's hungry to go on offense and also wants to take a nap. Not the whole, like, go back to brunch thing, but, like, regroup. And so, honestly, for me personally, the first thing I'm going to do is start having some strategy sessions where it's like, now we actually can see the terrain ahead of us. But a lot of these groups are like, get that the level of pressure that's exerted on Biden within the first 100 days is going to matter a lot more than pressure later. And so there are some groups, you know, and again, like I said, like a lot of the movements I come out of, I'm also highly critical of. And one of the things I'm critical of is that they're in the streets, they're doing community organizing, they're, you know, we are of the people, but also we've spent so many years not ever imagining that we'd actually be able to wield power, that we, like, a lot of our movements don't relate to the electoral arena. They don't. And there are some groups that are an exception to that. So, like, Sunrise, it has a plan, for example, on pressuring Biden around climate change, which I think is, like, one of my top priorities. And, mm-hmm. like, I think there'll be the conversation around a Green New Deal is going to shift. And I think we have an opportunity to just start sprinting. And I also think that, like, the way that everyone I know is fucking exhausted right now. And there's I was listening to an interview with Linda Sarsour, who she was like, I'm 40 and I feel like I'm 80. And I'm like, yeah, that's everybody I know. And I'm sure that's kind of everybody in general, but definitely for organizers especially. And so I do, though, think that, like, nothing builds a movement like winning. And so if we are put in this position where we have to, like, fight for the baseline and, like, drag this dude across the finish line, the networks that we build, the sense of empowerment that people have, like, all of that infrastructure stays. And then, yeah. And then we start moving it. And that's like what I was going to say earlier about the Argentina example. Like, Argentina was having military coups between the 1930s to 1987, right? And they didn't have any space to organize. When they finally stood up for democracy, they also basically ushered in, like, a milquetoast sort of, like, center left whatever, and they had some governments that then cut deals with the IMF and, like, did all of this terrible stuff.
Oh yeah.
But the networks that they built from fighting the coup then regenerated a left movement in Argentina that started winning really real gains. They, like, reunionized most of the country. They reclaimed all of these factories. They collectivized them. And so, to me, I'm like, cool, we'll finally have the wind at our sails. And, like, it's very exciting for me. I remember when, during Obama's campaign, there was a bunch of us who were like, okay, at what point will liberals get jaded with this dude? Like, it was before he won. We knew he wasn't going to meet these promises, but we're like, at what point can we make our timing right about, like, where we can actually fight this guy and not be seen as totally crazy?
That point never came, because the liberals are still obsessed with him and in love with him. They love him now more than ever, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the nostalgia for Obama's. But what's exciting to me is, like, I think that, you know, anyone who's gotten really engaged doesn't have illusions about Biden.
Yeah, even no one likes Biden. Yeah. No one likes him.
He's going to be easier to fight. Biden's going to be the easiest opponent that we've had in my lifetime, I think. He's going to be easier than Clinton, definitely easier than Bush, easier than Obama. And then, you know, Trump is like a brick wall. Like, that's just, you know. And so I'm actually, like, really excited to fight Biden. It's and that's to me, like, when I'm talking to other activists who are like, this dude sucks, I'm like, yeah. Don't you want to fight someone who sucks in a way that you actually can have the upper hand?
Right.
You know, yeah. Rather than someone who sucks in a way that's like, you know, you're facing a tank that has its gun pointed at you, you know? So I'm actually hopeful about that.
All right, that's beautiful, man. I think the message to everybody checking this out is that the fight, again, I just want to remind people about 2008 and that feeling after Barry had won, that it was some actual victory, right? It was sort of, it seemed like some destination of some racial harmony, all of this kumbaya in America. It felt like utopia. Yeah. We had finally reached utopia. Moses had finally brought us to the promised land. And that was clearly, obviously not the case. I think people have their eyes open. And as Josh just mentioned, be ready for the fight. So we got to move on to end off the show to, man, this guy Tom Cotton is something different, man. Like, his level of ambition, self-assuredness, he clearly thinks very highly of himself, but and that's problematic because he's just this average white dude, clearly. But what I think makes him somebody that we need to pay attention to, because he absolutely has his finger on the pulse of the purest form of right-wing-ism in this country. Like, he knows the buttons to push. When a guy takes out a New York Times, fucking New York Times op-ed to say we should roll tanks out into the streets to corral American citizens, like, that dude has some balls, and he's a psychopath. But, you know, that being said, he's one of the leading candidates to emerge in 2024. I know that sounds absurd, right? Yeah. That we're in the midst of basically the most important election of our lives. I always love when people say that. They say that every single election. But, the most important election of our lives. And we already have to sort of look askance at 2024. And that's because Tom Cotton is already campaigning, right? Whenever you hear the words Iowa and New Hampshire associated to a politician, we know what that means. That means such and such is ready to run. And Tom Cotton, as I said at the top of the show, the pathetic Democratic Party, my God, they couldn't even field a challenger for this guy in Arkansas. He's not running unopposed. There's some cranky libertarian candidate out there in Arkansas, which we know that guy's going to get crushed. Because he's essentially running unopposed, he's going out and he's doing his thing. He's taking out ads in all kinds of states. Again, when you go to the cornfields and shake the hands of potato farmers in the Midwest and, you know, those kinds of things 4 years outside of an election, we know what that means. I just want to know what you guys think about just the direction this is all headed for the GOP, because again, Tom Cotton is about as right wing as it gets in that party, and he seems to be hell bent on trying to run for president.
Well, here's why this is important to be looking at this point, is because the nightmare scenario of a Biden administration is that it's basically a repeat of Obama on steroids, and that there's this incredible economic crisis, like really one of the biggest economic crises that we've had in 100 years, and that they sort of under-deliver on the response, you know, that the response is just kind of half-assed, they don't go all the way, they don't really, like, improve people's lives, people's lives keep getting shittier as a result, and that fuels, as it always does, every single resurgent right-wing movement comes on the back of the economic crisis and the failure of a liberal, ruling regime to respond to it, that this fuels like an even bigger backlash to Trumpism. And, Trump, we all hate him, but we also recognize that he's kind of lazy and kind of dumb and doesn't really understand how this stuff works.
Right.
He's got like a feel for stuff, but he doesn't know how
he doesn't
the
know the nuts and bolts.
The power. Yeah, he doesn't know the nuts and bolts.
He's no
and
Dick Cheney.
So the nightmare is always like, what if Trump but competent, right? Like, you know, like, what if that happened? What if it was the Bush administration staffed by like these kind of career competent Republican psychopaths, but like more, right? That's the nightmare. And that's what Tom Cotton represents. So that's like why it's so important to push Biden and to not have any illusions about Biden, because if the Democrats do not respond to this economic crisis and the ecological crisis and all the myriad crises that we face, the sort of steady decline of the average American life, there will be a right-wing backlash, and Tom Cotton will be at the forefront of it.
You got to respect that long-term planning that he's got. That's impressive. It's also a reason why, I mean, I really think a lot, you know, we'll see what, I mean, if, let's say we do get Trump out of office, that dude's not leaving popular culture, right? Like, he's going to be in our faces still, you know, and I don't know whether that's like a media company or what. And I don't know what it means if his base is transferable to some other demagogue or not. Like, I don't know what, like,
does Tom Cotton have his
magic?
No, that's my hopeful thing. Look at Tom Cotton's face. He's got like a dopey, dumb
eminently
face.
Punchable yeah. face. Yes.
Yeah. And Trump, you know, once the base, yeah, very not, yeah, just a, like a dumb guy, just like a doofus, you know, and Trump is, you know, like once they got the real hit, you know, like once they got the hit of Trump, like they can't go for the soft stuff anymore. Like they need that. They need someone who's that good at owning the libs, right? That's Trump's appeal. One, like 90% of it is that he drives the libs crazy and these people hate the libs and that's why they love him. I mean, that's just, that's been the conservative movement's modus operandi for decades, is the people who do really well, from Ronald Reagan to Phyllis Schlafly to George W. Bush to Trump, is the people who make the libs' hair go on fire. The people who make the people who the libs love, like John McCain.
Or Marco Rubio.
Libs love John McCain. He kept on getting owned in elections. The Republicans don't want some guy who has like liberal respect. They want a guy who the libs fucking hate. You know, and Trump is such a strange way to troll the libs. You know, like there's no one like him. There's no one like Trump. So that's my hope, is that they, once they got a hit of the real thing, they can't go to like some Tom Cotton bullshit. Mm-hmm.
You know, and the crazy thing too, what's fascinating about this election cycle is I think a lot of the stuff that endeared Trump to Republican voters was the anti-immigrant stuff, which he's completely basically abandoned this cycle.
Yeah, no more build the wall.
He doesn't even talk about the wall anymore. It's over.
It's crazy.
They're like, what endeared him to them was finally somebody saying that shit out loud. Finally, somebody saying the truth. Mexicans are rapists. Duh. We all know it. They're all freaking coke dealers. Come on, man. They're getting our kids high on smack. Thank you. And he's completely abandoned that. So I wonder, you know, part of it makes me wonder how somebody's supposed to energize that base of people if the guy who invented it has even moved away from it. And I just can't imagine a Tom Cotton would come out and say, you know, let's start hanging niggers again. Like, I don't know. Like, I think that would make him very popular amongst those people. But I don't know that he would actually do it.
Yeah, my hope, too, is that, like, even if a Biden administration doesn't deliver for people, people's lives get worse, it makes them, like, you know, easily seduced by authoritarianism. If we have a big enough left that's distinguished from the liberals, where at least, you know, a lot of those people aren't necessarily going to come to the left. But this, I mean, this in many ways was also, you know, like, and this one of the reasons why I'm glad to be on the show. This was part of, you know, Michael Brooks's project, right? Of like, be accessible, be relatable, distinguish yourself from that bullshit. And that if there's a visible wing of the left fighting Biden, we might actually be able to siphon off a larger base of disaffected, angry people that like can also get over some of the culture war divisions and shit.
I mean, God knows that's the hope, man. Anyway, I just thought that people should keep their eye on young Tom Cotton. That guy is freaking hilarious and scary and just ridiculous all at the same time. I want to thank our guests, Joshua Kahn Russell, man, this was incredible. We generally just never have guests, but the past few weeks we've been going freaking crazy with luminaries like yourself and, you know, Bessemer and Anna, of course, of TYT. Just thank you for coming on and giving the people, you know, that knowledge about what actual dissent looks like, what it means to dissent from the power structure, what it means to exert our collective will on these asshole rich people. And so I'm happy that you were able to come on and do that for us. Of course, Nando held us down last week, killing it as always. Our producer, Rob Lopez, you know, can't thank you enough for the work you do for us, Rob. Make sure you become a Patreon of Count the Dings. That's patreon.com/countthedings. Support us. That's how we're able to put out content like this for you guys. Of course, make sure you're listening to Let's Pod It Out, Nando's hilarious Entourage recap pod, which is just, you know, it's such a time capsule, that show of about just a special time in American pop culture. You guys need to watch that. And Josh, can you please tell the people where to find you, the things that you're working on, and how they can learn more about it and check it out?
Yeah, I'll give a couple things. So the Choose Democracy pledge, and if you want to go to one of our trainings, is choosedemocracy.us. You can find me on Instagram at Joshua Con Russell. I'm thinking of coming back on to Twitter, which is just Josh Con Russell. So I'll make a debut there soon, I think. I mean, whatever. Also, there's another I run an organization called the Wildfire Project, wildfireproject.org. If you didn't get too many things to follow up on there, there's another one.
All good.
All right, perfect. Yeah. We will see you guys next week, man. We're out of here. Peace.